you are.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Is what's good for General Motors good for a new Afghanistan? When the terrorists struck the Twin Towers, they struck the symbolic heart of global capitalism. In this hour, can global capitalism fix the problem? First, troops and tensions build up along the India-Pakistan border. Earlier, I spoke with the New York Times' John Burns in Islamabad and asked if the countries are closer to or further from war.
It's very difficult to gauge that because it depends on how you measure India's intentions. One thing is clear here, and that is that Pakistan is not going to attack India. Pakistan has, from the start of this crisis, said that it seeks dialogue and peace. It is India that has threatened war. And India's intentions can be measured in a variety of ways. One of them would be by the continuing Indian military buildup on Pakistan's borders, which even today continued with the onward westward movement of three divisions of the Indian Army that have moved all the way across the Indian subcontinent from West Bengal, as India calls it, which is oddly on the east coast of India.
But presumably they have an interest in raising the pressure, but do they really want to go to war?
It's true, but when you put two armies of this size that close together and against the background of the passion and anger that has infused this issue of Kashmir for 50 years, it would take only one miscalculation on one spot along the line of control in Kashmir to potentially trigger something much more serious. So I think it would be unwise to underestimate this. On the other hand, you'd have to say that the governments in both countries are led by the same people, and you'd have to assume that that in itself would be some kind of guarantee against war between two countries which are, after all, nuclear armed.
On that point, is there a war scenario that does not lead to nuclear exchange?
Absolutely, there is. The Pakistan concern is that the Indians would attack in Kashmir and not across what is called the international border, that is the undisputed border that lies between India and Pakistan and has been unchanged since 1947, and that accounts for roughly two-thirds of the total 1,800-mile frontier between the two nations. But Kashmir, being a disputed territory, is not got an international border. It's a disputed territory.
Yes.
It's assumed by the Pakistanis that if an attack took place, it would take place in Kashmir. It would be conventional, not nuclear, and it would be intended to severely diminish Pakistan's ability to continue supporting any form of armed struggle in the Indian-held part of Kashmir, but it would not become nuclear. I think it's reasonably safe at this point to exclude any possibility of a nuclear exchange.
And if India did that and was successful, could Musharraf survive that politically?
Doubtful, I would say. Very doubtful. It's, when we say politically, really, I think what you have to look at, since after all this is a Pakistan is in a state of military rule, there is no parliament, and there are no elections.
So we're using politically very broadly here.
I think we have to look at the question of the leadership of the Pakistan army. General Musharraf reshuffled the leadership of that army a couple of months ago and got loyalists into all the key positions. But they would come under huge pressure probably from the middle officer corps, many of them Islamists or Islamist inclined, who might very well say in this case that General Musharraf had led India up a blind alley.
We see that today there was a grenade attack in Kashmir, 10 people injured. How does this change the chemistry?
Well, I think you need to remember this sort of thing has been going on for 10 years. And I think that differentiation needs to be made in the context of the war on terrorism and all the passions that has aroused between the struggle that's going on in Kashmir for self-determination, which was an indigenous struggle in the beginning, began in Indian-held Kashmir, which is occupied by several hundred thousand Indian troops, occupied by, staffed by, secured by, depending on what phase you want to use. So grenade attacks, ambushes, and this sort of thing happen regularly. There have, after all, been at least 30,000 and possibly 50,000 people killed in that war, and it's been continuing now for 10 years. So I think we want to be absolutely clear in our mind as to what is an ongoing conflict, insurgency, if you will, and what is terrorism.
John Burns, as you've written, Pakistan has taken some steps in response to India's outcry to rein in or at least cut support for the groups that may have been behind the recent attack on India's parliament. Has India given any indication that its anger is subsiding as a result of these things, that it's willing to take these as a first step on a path toward cooling off?
Well, of course, the level of rhetoric has diminished. Only last Friday we had the Indian defense minister in effect saying that India could sustain a nuclear exchange because it's a much larger country than Pakistan is, and Pakistan would disappear from the map. Since then, we've come down quite a way, and we have had the senior leaders of Indian government speaking of their preference for a peaceful situation. But the Pakistan's point of view, as expressed by President Musharraf in a telephone call to the United States ambassador yesterday, was at what point will the Indian pressure relent? How far will this go? Is Pakistan now hostage, in effect, to any incident anywhere in India in which some lunatic with a Kalashnikov attempts to kill somebody for which Pakistan could be blamed? I think it's a legitimate point, and this is without going to the question of who actually was responsible for the attack on the Indian Parliament, which is an issue that needs itself to be clarified. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that it was not Islamic militants based in Pakistan. In overwhelming probability, it was. But India has not presented, at least to Pakistan or to the United States or to the United Kingdom, mm-hmm. convincing evidence that that was the case.
Tony Blair is on his way to the region. What will he be looking for as a sign that things may be on a cooler path?
I think he would be looking for Pakistan to continue on the course that it has set now for some months, which is to rein in the Islamic militant groups in this country. And General Musharraf had begun to do that in quite remarkable ways before September the 11th, on the one hand, that there be no deviation from that course, and I don't think there will be. And on the other hand, from the Indian leaders, a recognition that what's going on in Kashmir is something other than simply terrorism, that they cannot use the war on terrorism, in effect, to suppress a movement in Kashmir, which is 50 years old, in effect, for the right to self-determination. And that's a much more complex issue.
John Burns is Afghanistan Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Islamabad. Remember the riots at the WTO conference in Seattle? And don't forget the nasty battle over sky-high prices of Cipro after the recent anthrax scare. Big business always gets its share of bad press, but how great a part of solving global problems can it actually be? Tonight's guest, Harvard Business School professor Rosabeth Moss-Cantor, says token corporate social responsibility programs will not be enough to stem the anti-globalization tide. More is required, she says. What do you think corporate America's role should be in fighting the root causes of terrorism, in rebuilding Afghanistan? What do you want from big business in the post-9/11 world? You can join our conversation with Rosabeth Moss-Cantor tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now in the studio is Rosabeth Moss-Cantor, professor at the Harvard Business School, specializing in strategy, innovation, and leadership for change. Good evening.
Good evening.
Also with us is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello and Happy New Year, Jack.
And to you and to Rosabeth and to everyone.
and to everyone. Rosabeth, here it is. The World Trade Center went down, and as you yourself have written and said, that meant something. That target had a meaning. The United States was targeted, but the impact of the global markets, of global capitalism, were also in the sights of the terrorists. So, after a decade in which we've looked to the markets for an awful lot, how much can we expect from global capitalism, from the markets, to help us fix up the situation we now find the world in?
Well, it's striking that during the last 5 or 6 years, when protests have risen against global capitalism, all the protests that you mentioned, World Trade Organization, mm-hmm. IMF meetings, etc., companies have been increasing their so-called corporate citizenship activities. They've been trying to do more about education, about poverty around the world, about economic development, and yet they're attacked in that same period. So clearly there's something wrong here. We do need business to behave in a more responsible way, but it's not clear that that's the solution. The drug companies that have very generous drug donation programs in Africa, yet they're still under attack for charging too much for prescription drugs in the mm-hmm. United States. Mm-hmm. For the WTO talks this November, activists managed to pressure both the U.S. and Europe to say that drug patents shouldn't be upheld. That poor countries should be able to copy the drugs if they need them. So there's something wrong here with how we've thought that the market could solve problems,
well,
that it can't. can't.
But you've written that there's a push to extend the public obligations of the private sector. And I guess that's what you're describing here. But you're saying there are limits to what the private sector can do? Is that the message?
Well, the private sector should certainly do more than it's doing now. And some companies are doing stellar and path-breaking things. Just on the drug company front, Merck has helped virtually eradicate river blindness in Africa, a parasitic disease that was paralyzing countries. And the impact are not only lives saved and people who can see, but it has a very positive economic impact. IBM has been contributing heavily to the reform of public education, not only in the United States, but all over the world. They have projects in countries like South Africa, Brazil. So the private sector is trying to get more involved. Stakeholders want it. They're under pressure to do it. Social reporting is growing. Companies are supposedly now trying to manage to what's being called the triple bottom line, not just how much money they're making for shareholders, but also the social impact and the environmental impact of what they're doing. So there's much more concern on the part of the public that companies do good. Their employees want them to do good. But the disconnect between the magnitude of the problems the world faces and how much we could expect businesses to do in their own self-interest. We can't do it by businesses alone. And there's one more pernicious impact. If we think that markets or business are going to solve these problems, then that's an excuse for having weaker government. And one of the problems that countries like Afghanistan have had is no government, no civil society, no volunteer sector. So we can't expect businesses to come in and solve all of those problems. They're not going to invest in countries that don't have a stable political system, that don't have laws, that don't have education. And so there's a lot of prior things that have to be done that are not in the hands of business at all.
But this sounds like a kind of a new message. There were many B-school folks from around the country in the 90s who were delivering the message, and of course conservative politicians as well, that the markets would take care of things. It sounds in your remarks like there's two streams here that we're talking about. One is corporate social responsibility programs, and the other is the whole global system itself, and that these are really two separate things you're saying.
Right. And we can't turn to the private. We can ask the private sector to do more. We can ask them to do their part, but they've got to do it in partnership with government. In the 90s, it's true. We said in America, free markets had won. Capitalism have triumphed. We even redefined those countries. We stopped calling them developing countries, the poor countries of the world, and we started calling them emerging markets. And there was a rush.
Next in line.
Yeah, there was a rush to invest in them, but they haven't paid off in many cases. And in part, that's because it's not just the market. That's because the fundamental institutions of society weren't in place. So, yes, I'm at the West Point of capitalism, the Harvard Business School, and I do believe that economic opportunity is vitally important. But you can't have economic opportunity if you don't first have an educated workforce, a healthy population, clean drinking water, a non-corrupt government.
Jack Beatty, we're 5 minutes in, and there's a lot on the table here. Rosabeth Moss-Cantor is saying the business can't do it all, the free markets can't do it all, that Afghanistan needs a government. There's a lot to dig into there. We'll look at what America needs in those terms as well. What does all this spark in your mind, Jack?
Well, I never thought, and I think a lot of people really never thought the market could do it all. It didn't here. It took countervailing power to make corporations maximally socially responsible. There's a famous sentence of Adam Smith: it is not to the benevolence of the butcher that we owe our meat, it is to his self-interest. Similarly, it is not to the benevolence of the corporation that we owe their socially responsible behavior. It is to regulation. It is to law. It is to forces that really say to the good companies, look, we're not going to sacrifice you and have you losing at competitive disadvantage by doing the decent thing. We're going to require all companies to do it. And there's a parable about our ergonomic rules we can get to that shows just that. Companies willing to take on these new regulations, but the extractive industries and the chicken pluckers saying, oh, no, we can't do that. And kind of a parable about what happens if you try to be decent in a competitive environment without government regulation.
And yet we all know that in the 90s the message was also out there, just take the lid off and the market will produce such wonders that it will drive the whole planet forward. Listeners, what do you think? What's the role of business, of global capital now, post-9/11? Join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back.
From UR.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the global market, global capitalism, and how much of the challenge set facing us after 9/11 that market, that capitalism, can address. Our guest tonight is Rosabeth Moss Kanter, professor at the Harvard Business School, specializing in strategy, innovation, and leadership for change, and our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. What do you think? What do you want? What do you expect from big business in this new era? Rosabeth Moss Kanter, we want to jump right back into this. The 90s were all about saying the market can do it. What have we learned? What are the things that the market is especially good at accomplishing? And what, from your B-school perch, do you see the market as not so well-equipped necessarily to provide?
Oh, the market is wonderful at encouraging entrepreneurship. And in fact, by the way, I think Afghanistan and countries of Central Asia and the Middle East would be better off if they had more of it, if they had more opportunities for people to start businesses, grow businesses, whether they're small or potentially larger. Because when people are busy being entrepreneurs, they don't want to be revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. In fact, they want to play in the world economy. So that's something the markets are really great at, incentives for people to use their initiative. What markets are not so good at is investments in the underlying long-term things that people need to be healthy and be in a position to exercise their initiative. We can't put long-term K through 12 education on a market basis and expect it to suddenly transform. I mean, I know this is controversial too. That's another question about America Now, is part of the Philadelphia public schools are being mm-hmm. taken over by the Edison Corporation, but incentives for things that produce a short-term return are one thing, but things that produce what are so-called public goods that everybody shares in, I mean, that are good for the society at large, require a different kind of investment. And what makes America great is, by the way, is not just our entrepreneurs in business, but that we're also very entrepreneurial in the social sector. We have a lot of volunteer organizations that start on an entrepreneurial basis, and those are not driven by money per se. They're driven by the opportunity to make a contribution. So there are other motives that drive people.
And yet in the 90s, and there was a very serious argument made for this, we can't ignore it just because we're 2002 now, the argument was that the very government infrastructure that might provide these public goods could also create a kind of social sclerosis that inhibited the magic of the market and innovation and the wealth creation that would eventually help everybody. What about that? Is that danger not still there in the groves of academia and B schools where you work and with the business people you work with? Aren't they still afraid of that?
Oh, well, especially in California, they are. I mean, in California, there are a lot of libertarians who said, you know, just leave us alone. No regulation, no public funding. In fact, many of the Silicon Valley types said, look, all we want in California is charter schools. They'll all compete with each other. The best will win, et cetera, et cetera. What they forgot was that even Silicon Valley, like Greater Boston, was made possible by huge government investments in basic research for technology, which created big industrial laboratories, which helped Stanford University become a source for that, or helped MIT spawn all those businesses. So it's not really either or. And I think we just need a more balanced perspective. I clearly believe in markets. I love watching businesses grow. That's what I devote my life to. I love innovation. I love finding a way for talent to be developed and used. But it would be a myth to say that happens because of some invisible hand of the market with no guidance, with no institutions. They just sort of pop up. In fact, government plays a very important role in creating the conditions that make markets possible and make them non-chaotic and cutthroat so that we have some degree of stability and certainty in our lives.
There's the new message from the Harvard B-School. Market mavens, do you buy it? Do you believe it? Is the message of the 90s that government was in the way really really dead? Is that the verdict of the 90s and of 9/11/2001? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, somehow I don't think you're going to argue against what Roosevelt Cantor's saying here. Do you think the verdict is that clear? Is 9/11 the full stop on the verdict?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that what happened in the 90s was there was a kind of hubris about the markets. And people were subject to a kind of historical myopia. Your colleague Thomas McGraw in his book Creating Modern Capitalism has a box of the various kinds of capitalism we've had in America. And the one kind we haven't had is laissez-faire capitalism. We ain't had it. We've never. And in the 90s, people said, let's experiment with it. Let's see what that will do. Well, you know, it's not the problems you raised about how it doesn't deal with the social goods are certainly true. But there's another side to it, too, that laissez-faire capitalism, capitalism with minimal regulation, creates social problems. Not only doesn't it ameliorate them, but it creates them in the form of externalities, environmental pollution and so on, but also in other ways and in a very pernicious way. Indeed, George Soros, the no-Leninist, said, you know, in the 90s, we were in danger of going from believing in a market economy, which we have, to believing in a market society where the values of the society were set by the market and where everything was for sale. And I think that was part of that hubris in the 90s. It's working in the markets. It's working in high tech. Maybe it'll work in society, too, in education, in law enforcement, in
Jack, Roosevelt, Moss Cantor, what about the examples of Japan, which had a lot more government intervention and planning and lots of infrastructure and languished through the 90s? And what about Europe with its high unemployment through the 90s?
Well, I don't think I'm talking about throwing out our market system. I mean, I actually would like to see, a little more investment in public education. But I actually think America is in pretty good shape. And I think there are signs that we're going to begin to recover from the economic crisis and so forth through market forces and minimal intervention, et cetera, although I was in favor of public works that would fix the potholes near my street.
Aren't we all?
But that's not the issue. There's another issue here, too. It's not just about markets. It's about the perception of the public about the power of giant corporations, because they don't see giant corporations as being subject to market forces. They see them as dominating. Mm-hmm. They see them as setting prices. They see them as a source of power that has too much influence over our lives, and that they're not accountable. So the other issue is, you know, I painted this entrepreneurial vision before about what's good about markets, but entrepreneurs sometimes turn into really big companies that want to stifle competition. And so that's where we want to set in and set some rules so that we constantly have innovation. The best thing about a market system is that you do get constant innovation. And government is often a source of seed money for the source of discovery. Yes, later it can be a drag, and sometimes it moves slowly, and bureaucracy can be frustrating, and we all hate rules. We would all love to be without rules, but we would like the guy across the street or our competitor to play by the rules.
Mm-hmm. We're going to look at what that right balance is, that fulcrum where everything balances just perfectly. But we have a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's bring them in. Imran is on the line. Welcome, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to go back to your, an original point that you brought up, which was global corporate citizenship and the perception that others have of U.S. companies. And I would like, maybe a question and a comment, and I'd like your caller to address it, and that is the issue of cigarettes. So we've gone through a huge...
The great American export.
Right, exactly. And to see us now trying to export cigarettes to the third world, Vietnam and other places like that, smacks of immorality. It's not good for us, but it's okay for others.
Do you think it breeds terror, Imran?
Well, you know, I read something very interesting on the internet today that somebody had emailed saying that in the Islamic world, so they should issue a fatwa which would ban smoking of cigarettes because it's not good for your health. And as a sideline that was in there, somebody, this author who kind of threw it out there, said that. It would cut the corporate profits of multinationals that are seeking to, basically destroy the health of our people.
Imran, I want to be sure we get your larger point. Are you saying that cigarette companies are an example of American corporations that don't show a socially conscious face to the world? Is that your point?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at cigarettes and what they do, I mean, we're saying to the world that, you know, it's not good for Americans, and that's why we're cracking down. But, hey, we'll export it to your country. And, you know, the question is, how moral is that, knowing what the consequences are?
It's a big question. Imran, thank you for your call. Elizabeth Moss Kanter, what about cigarette companies as a member of the pantheon that foreigners see of American capitalism?
Well, first of all, they're a representation of a larger phenomenon. There's been concern that we're not only exporting cigarettes because we can't smoke them here, but we want to export pollution to the third world. We want to export messy production to the third world because, you know, we won't take it here.
Manufacturing offshore that's not clean.
Yeah, kind of sweat. Well, you know, that you contract out to sweatshops. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now, companies are very sensitive to that because of callers like Imran and what's going on in the Internet. Mm-hmm. One of the pressures on companies right now is that consumers right here in the United States are now much more aware because of new media of what companies are doing in other countries, and they don't like it. They want companies to behave to the same standards. They want them to contribute positively to those countries and not export our worst stuff that we don't want anymore. And that pressure is in part what is going to push companies to have to be more socially responsible. And it is important that they do it, even if it won't solve all the problems, because they want to advertise it. They want to let their American customers know that they're doing good for those poor kids somewhere else and not trying to get them hooked on our drugs.
An awful lot of Americans may have many complaints, but at some fundamental level, they are persuaded that the markets work and that capitalism has worked. It's obvious it's worked for the United States. What's your perception of the foreign or the image abroad? How positive a force is global capitalism and its American face seen as?
I think that other countries are not as ideological about it as we are. That is, they don't see it as a way of life. They do understand that markets can bring good things, that competition can be a spur to higher performance. But they're also concerned about American dominance, that it's not global capitalism that's often under attack in these protests. It's often American capitalism and the dominance of American companies. The 200 largest corporations in the world, 82 of them are headquartered in the United States. So when we talk about globalization, it's often Americanization. And those other countries don't want to see American culture imposed on them with American products.
So are you saying that some kind of localization is a part of a more effective projection of the markets in the next decade?
I think that we should not even talk about globalization anymore. My term is localization, because we should talk about how we connect with what the needs, hopes, aspirations are of people on the ground in other countries and how we contribute to the quality of their lives, as opposed to just pushing our way on them. And that's one of the senses in which the behavior of American multinational corporations is connected to the root causes of terrorism.
John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're well, thanks.
Great. I find the conversation really interesting.
Good.
I had a question, though. You're talking about the benefits that these multinational corporations are actually providing to third world countries.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about when the governments of the host countries are aligned with the interests of multinationals?
So that there's no one to necessarily represent the local populace.
Yes, that's it. What if we're talking here of basically the triple alliance that you find in Brazil, where multinationals are getting lax environmental laws and breaks in taxes and wages and the outlawing of strikes and things like that. How do you go about accounting for that?
Accounting for it. Well, let's put it to Elizabeth Moss Kanter. And John, thanks for your call. What about it? He cites Brazil. There are other countries that get this rap. They get in line with the global corporations so that they are looked favorably upon. But a lot of people underneath aren't happy.
Yeah, well, I mean, that accusation has been leveled against aspects of the U.S. federal government, too, because of PAC money, corporate lobbyists, et cetera, that governments want to court companies that will bring in investment. There's also concern about corruption in weak governments in other countries. So here's the point in this larger conversation about capitalism. Let's not forget democracy. The criticism of corporations, I mean, corporations may in fact be behaving in good ways even when they get favors. The problem is it's not necessarily representative. It doesn't necessarily reflect the will of the people. And if we want to export values from America, let's export not only capitalism, but with it democracy, accountability, representation.
Yes, and commonly, people on the labor side who protest at Seattle are said to be Luddites, essentially opposed to globalization, and really saying, "Begar thy neighbor. We want jobs here and the hell with you." In fact, just the opposite is true. They want people abroad to have a floor upon which to stand so that the person in Brazil will have labor rights, be able to organize. Factories will have fire legislation, such as we have. There will be some minimum wages, not scaled to ours, but scaled to theirs. In short, globalization with the WTO gives us a chance for the first time in history to direct capitalism without interfering with it. Because if there's no place else to go and the whole world, standards of the whole world have to come up, humanity can live better through this very force that has made some live better.
Has
at the same time, through history, immiserated many.
Roosevelt Moskinter, do you buy Jack's portrayal of the protesters at the WTO meetings as standard bearers for global labor? And, you know, if you only pass fire regulations, we're happy to have your capitalism?
Well, I mean, I love a lot of that argument because I would like to believe that we could raise standards everywhere in the world. There are a couple of problems with it, though. One problem is that actually, some of our companies have tried to set higher standards for suppliers in other parts of the world, and they've been attacked for driving out local companies that couldn't possibly meet those standards because
Bangladesh
they can't
comes
afford
to mind,
to.
Child labor.
So this is a difficult problem. This is, again, why we can't make it just a matter of what standards our companies bring when they go to coffee plantations in Colombia, as Starbucks does. You know, they have standards for their suppliers. There's some concern, again, about imposing standards that other countries can't meet. But our labor people, yes, I mean, they would rather keep jobs here. That is true. But I think that those movements are genuinely concerned about the fate of the worker. And I believe that there are many well-intentioned capitalists leading corporations, too. On the other hand, the behavior of some companies is sometimes they ignore the problems in their midst. So we need these countervailing forces to push at them in order to set standards. But I don't think voluntary standards or codes of conduct will work. And in fact, by the way, while I've talked about localization and that we can't count on the markets, I think that post-September 11th, some amazing things have happened that will actually accelerate globalization. One is international cooperation. I mean, here the Bush administration that came in with a kind of isolationist mood.
Our way or the highway.
Yeah, has forged coalitions. And suddenly we are aware of standards in all kinds of parts of the world. I mean, there's Afghanistan on television every day. Look, I mean, I've met wonderful, sophisticated people from Afghanistan, but those pictures make it look a little medieval there.
At best, sometimes. Roosevelt Moskinter, we have to take another break. You're great. Listeners, join us. We're talking about the markets. We're talking about global capitalism and how all this can be harnessed to make a better world post-9/11. What can business do to address the root causes of terrorism? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about global markets, global capitalism, and the post 9/11 world. What do you want from American CEOs? Profits or social consciousness? And can we have both? Will the markets take us to a peaceful world? We're joined tonight by Roosevelt Moskinter, professor at Harvard Business School, and our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, just before the break, we were talking about you sort of laid out the list of things that the protesters at the WTO meetings have had that they want set right about the world, but we've also seen government after government that have made the free functioning of markets impossible around the world.
Yes, and people like me who reflexively call for managed trade really have to face up to how the real world works. And how it works is through politics. We just saw in this fast-track legislation in the House that passed by one vote that essentially gives the president the ability to negotiate trade treaties here in this hemisphere without congressional amendment, passed by one vote. To get that one vote, the textile interests in South Carolina basically insisted that we abandon this Caribbean Basin Initiative, which was under the Clinton administration, an effort to lower tariffs, to make markets work so that poverty in the Caribbean region and secondarily in Africa could be alleviated, not through government, but through free trade.
Give Haiti a chance.
We could buy some of their goods. That has gone out the window in order to get fast track. So any good that can come out of fast track in terms of opening markets has been considerably abridged by the political price we paid in order to get fast track. And people like me who talk about managed trade and government role in it have to face the fact that politics enters into this. Our steel industry now, sheerly through political influence, is being protected by this administration and will be more. And that's a tax on all Americans. And that's done sheerly through political muscle. Now, I don't have a long-term answer for that, but people like, you know, who pick up the end of the stick that says politics have to face the fact that it can muddy the waters and interfere in the hopeful dynamics of markets, which are, let's buy your goods, you buy my goods, and the whole of us rise together.
Jack, Rosabeth, Moss Cantor, let's get some more callers in here. We've had a lot piled up this hour wanting to come in. Tim is on the line. Welcome, Tim.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening.
I've had the privilege of working for the last 25 or so years in the whole corporate responsibility movement from the perspective of shareholder activism. And I really resonated with what Professor Cantor was saying about the pressures that students and consumers, and I'm sure she would add, concerned shareholders have added on issues like sweatshops and the environment.
Mounting pressure, and she's written about that. Yes, Tim,
that's
your question.
Right. But I think the earlier point that she made is awfully important, as we're celebrating what Merck and IBM and other companies are doing, and as we're lamenting what Philip Morris and Unocal is doing in Burma, for example, I think we have to ask the big question about whether companies have as a goal to deal with issues of poverty and economic development. And I would suggest that there are very few major corporations who see this as their role. They see themselves as being good community citizens.
Mm-hmm.
They see themselves as having a positive role where they do business. But to take on a huge issue like looking at economic development and massive poverty in a developing country, it frightens all of us, but it also...
Sure.
Is not what most CEOs think about in terms of their own role.
Tim, it's a great point. Hank, stay on the line. Let's see what Rosabeth Moss Cantor has to say. And what about it? I mean, can companies even begin to think in terms of addressing these issues? Or really, is their role to pursue their own interests? And are we to trust that that will result in this better world?
I think companies should pursue, I say this with a little bit of caution, but pursue their own interests or use their core skills as long as they can also contribute in a positive way to the community around them, which means then that there have to be other institutions in that community and in that society that do the work. In the Philippines, I was consulting a few years ago to a company called San Miguel. It's the biggest beer in Asia. San Miguel is a food and beverage company. They've got the Coca-Cola franchise, and they were contributing heavily to Philippine Business for Social Responsibility, which is a corporate citizenship group, and to the development of poor villages, because that's their country. They live there. That's their market. In other
cuts both ways. They were also a big supporter of Ferdinand Marcos for many years.
Well, you know, there's those politics again that Jack was talking about earlier. But their prime goal is not social and economic development. Coca-Cola itself.
Beer.
Yeah, and Coca-Cola itself has argued that its biggest contribution to economic development around the world is that it employs people and that it employs local suppliers, that it creates jobs. And in some ways, businesses should stick close to their core functions of creating jobs, of educating people, of giving young people opportunities to work. And if they move beyond that, it should be for a good reason, because even the activist shareholders still want the companies in which they invest to make money.
But we're suggesting tonight that the invisible hand is not quite adequate. And yet, we spent years now dismantling government structures that had been adjudged by the body politic in this country as inadequate somehow. I mean, people voted in the poll booth for this to happen. So what comes into the vacuum here? If the invisible hand's not going to do it, is government going to step up? Can you see the Bush administration encouraging somehow some global orchestration of the market? It's hard to imagine.
Well, I'll tell you something interesting, and maybe this is confidential and I shouldn't say it on the radio
Too late now. Let's go.
You're right, exactly. But I was in the UK a couple of weeks ago, and I was meeting with Tony Blair's think tank people. He's got a think tank, a kind of skunk works in the UK government. And I was asking the people around the table what their assignments were. And some were a little absurd. One person was working on sports. And I was thinking to myself, there should not be a government role in sports. But there was a person there who had just gotten the assignment from Prime Minister Blair to give him a think piece on how to build world community. Now, is that amazing or what?
This from the heir to Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, well, but this is, he's now emerging as a world statesman.
He's been very eloquent on the need for development.
And if I weighed in on that and said, well, the things you can do in part, you do it through some government action, orchestrating things that the British government can do, but you do it by joining partnerships, by creating coalitions locally, where you use the skills and expertise of business, but in partnership with government officials and nonprofit or NGOs, because they're the ones that really carry out the activity on the ground. So that's the answer to Tim's question. I mean, companies should contribute their best skills, but work through the voluntary sector, through nonprofits and with government. And everything businesses do should help strengthen the capability of government rather than undermine it, because that will ensure for businesses themselves the best climate in which to do business, you know, without corruption or crime or the things that, or health crises. Like South Africa, you know, a high proportion of the female population is going to die of AIDS in the next 5 or 6 years, leaving, in a country with 30% unemployment, leaving a lot of males between 18 and 30 years old unemployed without women. Now, if that isn't a recipe for crisis, I don't think terrorism, but certainly violence and crime.
That sounds like enough to get any even global CEO's attention. Elizabeth Moss Kantor, the time has flown by, and we're just about at the end of it. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. I will. Elizabeth Moss Kantor is professor at the Harvard Business School and author most recently of Evolve, Succeeding in the Digital Culture. You can read Elizabeth Moss Kantor's Corporate Citizenship Meets the Anti-Globalization Backlash online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. And you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Jack Beattie, before we go there, what do you make of all this? Do you see the Bush administration opening the door to a new kind of global market exercise?
I don't, but I wish it would. But, you know, to get back to what companies can do, what we want them to do is to innovate. We want we want tomorrow incubated. And we want a government tax policy shaped around that. You know, it's about time we awoke to this. And, you know, Paul Romer, the economist, says, you know, we even have to think of our antitrust laws in the light of technological innovation. And what is it? Would companies take risks if they didn't think they could have temporary monopolies? So we have to rethink what is the golden goose here, and that's innovation.
Jack Roosevelt, thanks so much for being with us. Tonight, we continue our series of conversations with poet Robert Pinsky about poetry and times of conflict. As poet laureate during the Clinton administration, Pinsky started the Favorite Poem Project. The project collected the voices of Americans from all walks of life reading their own favorite poem. I asked Robert Pinsky about how poetry balances the chaos of war with peace and beauty.
It's a balance that was very much in the mind of one young man who wrote to the Favorite Poem Project with a poem he loved, and he is indeed in the military. I must be careful not to call him a soldier since he is a Marine. He did write us a letter about balancing political concerns and great global concerns on the one hand with personal human feelings on the other hand. Mm-hmm. Steve is from a Cuban exile family. He served as an infantryman in the Gulf War. And he relates the poem, his desire to maintain a part of himself that is far from politics, far from war, and on a more individual level. And it's Yeats's poem, Politics.
Read here by Steve Contiaguero.
How can I, that girl standing there, my attention fix on Roman or Russian or on Spanish politics? Yet here is a traveled man that knows what he talks about. And there's a politician that has both read and thought, and maybe what they say is true of war and war's alarms, but oh, that I were young again and held her in my arms.
Robert Pinsky, the Favorite Poem Project brought in so many poems, and I'm personally heartened to hear our U.S. Marine, Steve Contiaguero, choosing this and throwing it to you and saying, this is my favorite. What do you hear there?
If you could see letters we received, you would see that, like Steve's letter, they break the stereotype of Americans as not liking poetry.
Yeah.
I have a poem I'd like to read as a sort of a counterpart, almost in the opposite direction of Yeats's Politics. The truth is, war and war's alarms do affect us, and we can't just look at a pretty girl and wish we were young. Mm-hmm. And feeling a lot of us have had since September has been that it was only in some other former, in effect, ancient world that we could pretend that politics and war's alarms had no effect on us. Mm. This is a wonderful poem written by Carlos Drummond de Andrade, the Brazilian poet, translated from the Portuguese by Mark Strand. The poem is called Souvenir of the Ancient World. Clara strolled in the garden with the children. The sky was green over the grass. The water was golden under the bridges. Other elements were blue and rose and orange. A policeman smiled. Bicycles passed. A girl stepped onto the lawn to catch a bird. The whole world, Germany, China, all was quiet around Clara. The children looked at the sky. It was not forbidden. Mouth, nose, eyes were open. There was no danger. What Clara feared were the flu, the heat, the insects. Clara feared missing the 11 o'clock trolley, waiting for letters slow to arrive, not always being able to wear a new dress. But she strolled in the garden in the morning. They had gardens. They had mornings in those days.
Carlos Drummond de Andrade's Souvenir of the Ancient World, and all he's longing for is a garden. Robert Pinsky, we are so soaked in media and images now. Where is that private place where we can compose poetry? Does it carve out something for us that's away from the, as you say, the alarms of war? They're before us on screens half of our lives now when the war is on.
I find it a comfort myself. I mean, the scale of the bombing in Afghanistan, the scale of those immense buildings with immense airplanes crashing into them, it is also enormous. And poetry is large in a completely different way. In scale, it's on the scale of Contiaguero's voice or my voice, reading words that were written by one person sometimes long ago. And that recapturing of something that not exactly private, because it does involve other people. It does involve a whole large world and its concerns, but personal, on a personal scale. That's something very valuable. I think we've come to crave a lot in response to the scale and ubiquity of media.
Robert Pinsky is a former U.S. Poet Laureate and the creator of the Favorite Poem Project. To listen to other installments of our series on poetry and conflict, and to read the poems featured in the series, check out our website, go to wbur.org, and click on Special Coverage. You can also learn more there about Robert Pinsky's Favorite Poem Project. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
This is WBU.